Hi, I'm Keith.
Hi, this is Ragini.
And welcome to More Than Masala, a podcast where a chef and a culinary researcher talk about spices from the Indian subcontinent, from how to use them to sometimes the dark history behind their origins. Every episode, Ragini and I do a deep dive into one spice and talk about the history as well as how to use the spice. Welcome to episode 4, cumin.
Once it has been introduced into a new land and culture, cumin has a way of insinuating itself deeply into the local cuisine, which is why it's become one of the world's most commonly used spices. Gary Nabin, Cumin, Camels, and Caravans.
Ragini, how are you doing today?
I am good, Keith. How are you? We're at episode 4.
This is pretty monumental. 4 episodes in, and first of all, thank you to everyone who listens to us rant. We love what we do, and this is a blast. So you ready to talk about a new spice today?
I totally am. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to our podcast, and so you get a little notification when the next one comes out, because if you're listening to this, then we know you love nerding out on this as much as we do. So go on. You know you want to.
Yeah, you definitely want to. And if you don't want to, now you want to. But today we're here to talk about cumin or jeera. Cumin is so exciting to talk about for me because of so many uses. And as always, we are going to talk about some really cool history. But kind of wanted to start this off and say, you know, cumin is really, really used everywhere. Like, Is there any part of the subcontinent where cumin is not used, actually?
I mean, cumin is, it's that spice. It's, like you said, it's literally everywhere. And so the subcontinent, it's pretty much ubiquitously used across all the way from Afghanistan down to Kodaikanal in the south, I imagine, and into Central Asia. And actually, I mean, I don't know where people draw the South Asian boundary, but it goes well into Central Asia and it's a really common spice there as well. Into China, obviously, think of like the use of, you know, the cumin lamb, for example. Like a lot of cumin is used in China, and actually maybe more than one would expect. And then the Mediterranean, the Middle East, it's a major, major spice in those parts as well. It's a major spice in North and East Africa, over the oceans into Mexico. Like, you can't imagine like tacos without cumin, right? Like, like it's such a crucial spice there too. And then later the southern United States as well. So, you know, dal, garam masala, phul, tacos, chili, cumin is kind of what makes all of those dishes what they are. And I think it's because it has this like earthiness that lends itself well to other flavors. In fact, in the quote by Nabin, he talks about why cumin was the right spice for the title of his book. And it's because it demonstrates culinary globalization perfectly, according to him. And it goes well with, you know, it goes well with everything, but it goes particularly well with beans and lentils, which so many people rely on for protein and carbohydrates and basic subsistence, essentially. So whether it's dal or hummus or stews or phul or, you know, whatever it is, or in Europe, you think about like cheeses and then cumin used in cheeses. So yeah, a long answer to your short question is cumin really is everywhere.
Yeah, it really, really is. I think you nailed it too, right? Like how, I can't imagine garam masala or a taco without cumin, but is it actually one of those few spices that is from the subcontinent?
No, definitely it's not. I mean, there's lots of stories about where cumin is from, and the subcontinent doesn't feature in them. So it's originally from somewhere in the Mediterranean, but it's actually so old that there are theories of it originating everywhere from Palestine to Lebanon, Iran, Syria, all the way to Greece. So we know the sort of climate. It's, you know, dry. It's sort of dry, arid climate where it does the best. The subcontinent wasn't where it originated. But obviously, there are parts of the subcontinent that are very dry and arid. So it grows very well there once it came, which is part of why it's so popular and also one of the cheaper spices on the subcontinent as well. But from the Mediterranean, it first actually spread so to India, China, Southeast Asia by the very early caravan routes, which we've talked about a couple of times on this podcast. And by the 4th century, it was kind of a major export to the Roman Empire. And I mean, the Romans will keep coming up because they really did love their spices. And they used it in some really interesting practices. So when soldiers were going to war, they would crush or sorry, they would give it to them in like a little cloth. They would give them some cumin, and that was meant to keep them from like cheating on their wives while they were at war. Just like, it's like, sniff this cumin and you'll be good. Like, don't worry about it. Just sniff cumin. Like,
I have a business for us. We can revitalize this.
Exactly. All the militaries of the world, are you listening? We've got this. But then they also used to like crush it and just use it on bread as a spread, which I think is really interesting, because if we look at how it's used all over the world today, it's not really used in that way very commonly. There may be one or two examples, but it's not commonly used, you know, the way that sesame is crushed and used as a paste quite commonly, or peanuts are, or nuts are. Cumin really doesn't, like, I don't know, can you think of anywhere where there's like cumin spread on toast? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, you can think of rye for sure.
Yeah.
And things like that, but not cumin. That's an interesting one.
Yeah, so it kind of, I guess it sort of fell out of favor with the Romans, so I don't know how good it was, but they did it for a while at least. So.
But at least they were faithful to their wives.
At least they were faithful to their wives.
Knowing the Roman Empire, they had no problem, you know, just being monogamous. Oh, that's so cool. I want to come back to something that we talked about in the last episode, right? We talked a lot about, you know, just we've kind of skirted around the spice trade here and there, and we keep coming back to this idea that we have no real idea about how old the spice trade is, right? You know, we only know like what's recorded. But I guess my question is, but if they've traveled for so long, if people have traveled all this way, why are they only adopted in certain places? Why are these spices only kind of like, you know, we have the origin in certain places?
That's, that's a great question. So I'll come at it in a slightly roundabout way. So like you said, we spent a lot of time skirting around the issue, and we've talked a little bit about farming when we talked about saffron and cardamom specifically. We talk about the stories of spices and, you know, their religious symbolism or their cultural symbolism. And then we, you know, discuss the taste as well. And I keep saying this line that spices are the quiet heroes of history. And they were, because they were sort of the raison d'etre for much of the caravan routes taking, you know, flavors and stories across the known world. And we know the caravan routes that are marked, but we can assume that there were several routes that, you know, we no longer have access to today, or enough remnants of, to create the exact route that was followed. So what are spices, right? Like, let's pare this back a little bit. So spices themselves are essentially chemicals to deter herbivores from ruining plants. And so they're poison. Like, if we were smaller organisms, then these spices would kill us. And, you know, that is their first purpose in life, is to protect plants. And then at some point we realize that not only is the human body able to withstand the poison of spices, but we actually take a lot of benefit from them and also quite enjoy the taste. But survival has obviously always come before taste, and everything we think of as taste for a spice is actually just its poison for a smaller organism. So it's that kind of like their antimicrobial compounds of these spices that protect plants from predators that also serve to preserve food. And so when we discover that, okay, they preserve food, they do good things to our body, they all do slightly different things, but they're all good. And then they also taste good. But taste was definitely kind of the last thing that is important when we're talking about food, which is counterintuitive to the way that we eat today. But if we look at a lot of ancient cuisines, like, taste is at the absolute bottom of their pyramid in terms of priorities of what the food should do. So several reasons why we consume spice, but this was a major one, is, you know, food preservation and then taste. And there was a study out of Cornell that noted that the hotter the climate, the more spices were called for in the recipes. So if you think of, like, you know, traditional meat dishes from the subcontinent, like your favorite, nihari, it's a mixture of like over 20 spices, right? Like, it's, and if you think about it, it comes from the dry, hot North Indian climate that it was prepared for, which kind of is in line with what this study says. And it makes sense. And this is assisted by the fact that spices grow more abundantly in these climates. So you think about, you know, where spices grow, they grow in places where people use them the most. Mm-hmm. And so the Mediterranean, obviously the birthplace of many, many spices that we use today, Southeast Asia, South Asia, and then to a lesser extent, South America and the Caribbean. And so it also follows that because of access, as well as kind of the topical requirements of where you are, cooler places didn't require as much spicing of the food. You could leave a slab of meat out in the Canadian winter pretty comfortably for a couple of days and like nothing's going to happen to it, right? Without the option of, you know, of having that kind of cold or temperate climate, you needed spice to preserve the food. So you make a nihari and you can leave it out for a couple of days and nothing's going to happen to it. It's going to be okay. So this is also why actually spices like pepper and cumin, this is kind of weird, but they were used in like the mummification process in Egypt, and that was to better preserve the body. So one reason that people talk about is, you know, you send the ancestors off with valuable spices, but the other is that the spices actually would help to preserve the body for longer than, you know, the natural process would otherwise allow it to look like that person, I suppose. And so this kind of gave rise to like this predisposition in certain parts of the world to develop the taste for spice or crave spice, right? Like people who maybe their ancestors haven't eaten a lot of spice, they may not crave it. They may learn to enjoy it, but that may be a new thing, whereas certain people are born with this kind of sociocultural, what they call a sociocultural gene, is to crave certain spices. But I don't know, I think the modern way that we eat is probably changing this up quite a bit.
Yeah, you know, it's so fascinating listening to that, because like I have about 9 million other questions. But before I even jump into the other ones, on a side note, how cool is it that you're sitting in India talking about spices and I'm in New Hampshire in the United States and we're able to have this incredible dialogue about spices? Man, let's give it up for technology.
Seriously.
So cool. You know, you said something that I want to kind of elaborate or just dissect a little bit here. You talked about South Asia having this, like, you know, it has this tendency to take over spices and start consuming and like also producing the most. Is that like the same sort of idea that you're talking about here?
Yes. So about 70% of the world's cumin is grown in India, and India also consumes per capita the most cumin in the world, followed actually by China, which again may be surprising because when I think of Chinese cuisine, I only think of one region that uses cumin, but they actually use enough that it's the second largest consumer in the world as well. And so there's different kinds of cumin, obviously. There's the common cumin, which is somewhere between a khaki and kind of a pale brown, and that has the 9 ridges in each seed. And on the subcontinent, this is the one that grows the most abundantly in Rajasthan and Gujarat. So we're talking, you know, Western, arid, hot land, exactly the kind of climate that cumin is going to thrive in, and lots of farmland in these parts as well. So actually a lot of dal and spices grow in this part of the country. And then interestingly, some of the best quality cumin and black cumin grows in the Hindu Kush mountains up in Afghanistan. And so the variety of black cumin, and if you remember, even when we talked about saffron, we talked a little bit about the saffron that grows in Afghanistan, because that was planted as a replacement for the poppy fields that were there before it, or the opium fields, I suppose, that were there before that. But cumin is something that's actually grown there for ages, and it's not as large an area as you have in India, at least. But the cumin that grows there is meant to be some of the highest quality black cumin. And so this particular variety, it's only found in this sort of isolated corner, and you'll recognize it as cumin, but it's like nothing you've ever tasted before. Like, it's very, very flavorful. It's super woodsy. It has very deep pine notes. We talked about cumin having kind of an earthiness that is, you know, that sort of sits on the front of the palate. This is sort of a deep pine. If you think of like an Islay whiskey as opposed to, you know, as opposed to like a bourbon whiskey, like that's the kind of difference in the level of depth between the regular cumin and the black cumin. So yeah, I mean, it's The Afghans use it in their garam masala, and they have a distinct masala called char masala, which char is, you know, four, as you know. Char is four, and so char masala, which is a four spice, which is basically a combination of this cumin, coriander, turmeric, and chili. And the reason that I wanted to highlight the spice is because I don't think we often talk about Afghanistan when we're talking about South Asian foods, but it's such an interesting culture because it's right at the crossroads of South Asia and Central Asia. And I think the dish that you cooked this month is sort of highlights that perfectly. So what a great segue I've created for you to talk about the dish.
You know, I was actually just going to bring it up because you set that up so perfectly. We talked about, so before I even get to it, I want to throw us a wrench in here and talk about, because you described it so nice, like that woodsy pine note from the black cumin you were saying in Afghanistan. Is that correct?
Yep. Yeah.
That's so. So is that when you're going into like Indian grocery stores and stuff? Because I obviously have a limited exposure. The what's the black cumin called? Is it the shai jeera? Is that the same?
So it's called kala zeera. Literally black cumin, and then also shai zeera. So I think it just depends where you're buying it, and who's kind of done the translation. Shai zeera is also something that was used significantly in the Mughal cuisine, and that's maybe where it gets the name. Shah is, you know, essentially royal, and so that may be where it gets that name. But yeah, so shai zeera, or so royal cumin or black cumin.
Oh, that's so cool. See, I'm just nerding out and making sure that we go off script so that I can get my questions answered. But let's talk about this month's challenge, because it was so interesting. So why, you know, the big question is, why did I cook manti? And what's the difference between manti and mantu? Because I have some familiarity here.
So the difference is just kind of where it is, right? Like you have from East Asia, all the way into Central Asia, all the way into Eastern Europe, you have some version of the dumpling in every society, right? And so it is kind of just this similar version of the Turkish name mantu. It's a variation of that. It's the Afghan variation of that name. And the reason that I had you cook it was exactly for that reason, that it's such a perfect dish at the crossroads of South Asia and Central Asia, because it's these Central Asian type dumplings. But then you have a zeera spice chana dal on top of them. And to me, that's like, it's just the best of both worlds.
It's such an incredible dish. Dumplings are one of those things that, so in my girlfriend's family, they're part Chinese. And so there's a lot of dumplings. There's a lot of really connecting with their roots there. And so to get my hands on something like this and to work with this was really like mashing her culture with my passion. And so it was really amazing. And the thing that I learned about these, and from having manti before as well, you can just like crush a bunch of these and they're so delicious.
So easily, right? It's so easy to lose track of how many you're eating. It's also, you know, when you order dim sum and they bring you like four or six in an order, and I'm like, hey, these are gonna go down real easy.
and you can see my adaptation. I did a lamb version of these. You can see that so on good. Our pages. So if you go to Instagram at Keith Saracen or our Facebook page, More Than Masala Podcast. And even Ragini might post, you know, you never know. And even if she doesn't, if you need to visit her Instagram, because it's one that I always keep going to. And I'm like, man, I feel like every time I go to your Instagram, I learn something new.
That's very kind of you to say, but no, of course I'm going to post it. So yeah, if you want to, you guys can check it out wherever you want. We'll give you all the options. So Keith Saracen, More Than Masala on Facebook, or Third Culture Cooks on Instagram as well. So wherever you want to check it out, go look at his manti, and you can link the recipe that we used as well, because I really like that recipe. And so if anyone wants to try it out, they can totally do that too.
Yeah, that's going to be a thing that I do more of, and I know the people around me will benefit. But let's kind of bring it back to one final question that I have for the day, and that's cumin And Zira, with a Z or Z, depending on where you're from, not Jira. those are two very different root words. But can you talk a little bit about the roots and kind of give us an idea there?
Yeah, absolutely. So quick note on the Zira versus Jira before I get to the difference between that and cumin is that's actually a difference of Urdu and Hindi. So if you're typically from an Urdu speaking background, so for example, my family was from the western side of Punjab prior to partition. So we always said Zira because they all wrote and they all wrote in Urdu. That was the script that they learned other than English was Urdu. So we always say Zira. And then in India, more commonly, I've heard Jira. But to my ears, that sounds wrong because I didn't grow up hearing it. Like I grew up hearing, you know, the Z and not the J. But that is a difference of just Urdu and Hindi, nothing else. So we don't. Yeah, I think that's just something that we gloss over a lot and we just assume it's different pronunciations. But they are actually from slightly different text languages, if not spoken languages. But in the English speaking world, cumin is a particularly interesting spice linguistically because the name can actually be traced all the way back to the first written language, which is cuneiform of the Sumerian period, which, having taken the food and politics course, Keith, you will remember well, I'm sure.
I do.
So we see it recorded from records in the Sumerian period as gamun, so G-A-M-U-N, and this is about 4,000 years ago. So, you know, cumin is nothing new. It's been around for a while. And in most languages, so all European languages in Arabic, Hebrew, Cantonese, Amharic, Egyptian Arabic, they all use words that are pretty obviously derivatives of the original gamun. Let's go with gamun. And then the other root word is obviously jira or zira, like we said, which is used widely, primarily on the subcontinent. And so now cumin appears to have shown up in the subcontinent sometime in the years just before 300 BCE, when it's first mentioned in texts. And so early names were Ajaji and Kuchika, the root of which I really can't tell you. However, at some point, the Sanskrit word Jiraka, which is actually from the old Persian word Zira. So, you know, Urdu, the written language, comes from Persian. So you see that the Sanskrit, you know, predecessor of Hindi, you see the J, you see it right up there. So the Sanskrit word Jiraka, which comes from the old Persian word Zira, and they both mean to digest or to ferment. And that is the root of Jira or Zira on the subcontinent. And yeah, like I said, this also puts the, who says it right, the Jira gang or the Zira gang to rest because they're both right. So chill out. Everyone's right.
Everyone's right. Chill out. Ragini 2021. I love that.
So I just wanted to end that by saying that, like, what's really interesting as well is that not only is it used everywhere, but it's also one of the spices that pretty much has the same name in all subcontinental languages as well. Like, it's very, very, it's very recognizable. When we talk about some of the other spices that are to come, they have quite different names, but Zira and Jira, they, again, use very similar names across the subcontinent.
So cool. So cool. For anyone who doesn't know, I'm a huge nerd when it comes to linguistics, and I love learning languages, and man, it's been a wild ride. I feel like to properly, you know, there's like, what, over 20-something languages that are spoken in the subcontinent, I think it is?
Yeah, officially.
Yeah, and man, I think I speak one very brokenly, so I'm getting there.
Okay, but you, like, do you remember the first time that at least you used it in Indian food, or maybe you remember, did you associate it with something else before you started cooking Indian food the way you do now? Did you associate it with another cuisine? Like, tell us about your journey with Jira. Don't mind my alliteration.
The Journey to Jira by Keith. So yeah, I obviously in the West there was some uses for it. I think, you know, in the West we the classic chili con carne, you know, chilies. So I want to separate chilies from chili. Chili is a dish that's typically meat and beans. It's almost like a stew. And then in the East we always say chilies. So in chili in the West, you use a lot of cumin. Cumin works really well on pork as well. So there's a lot of like crossover there. But when I started cooking food from the subcontinent, it changed dramatically. For instance, I remember very clearly the first time I started putting oil and then throwing in cumin seeds till they start to pop.
Right.
You know, that wasn't like a thing that we typically do too much, that tempering technique to start layering flavors. Mm-hmm. We do that in a very different way. So in the West, we do a lot of mirepoix, which is right. obviously has its roots in French and European cuisine. So I think for me, working with cumin on that front was really, really new. Then obviously having cumin in other things as well. I feel like cumin and lamb are like best friends and they just mm-hmm. belong together, you know, ready to hang out all the time. So that was another big realization for me. Yeah, and then it started opening up all these other avenues where, you know, I remember the first time that I used a mortar and pestle to make cumin powder. And the smell was nothing like you would ever get with just cumin powder in the store. I was right. like, whoa, what in the world is this? So that led me to like the exploring of grinding my own spices and how much that put, you know, the only way I can put it is like it put soul and spirit and life into all of these dishes, where a lot of the powders that are sitting on a shelf are kind of stale and mm-hmm. dead in a way, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. I think it's so cool that you can kind of talk about your journey with these spices, because it's remembering taste as at a time when you can actually describe it is so different. Whereas for me, Zira is just sort of this thing that was always in the dal that you were eating at lunch. And apparently when I was like 2 or 3 years old, someone put dal in front of me and I looked at my mom and I was like, this dal doesn't have enough Zira in it. And she was like, you're 2.5 years old. Stop. Just do something else with your time. So to say that I remember the first time I ate it, I don't.
That's the most Ragini thing I think I could, you know, I can just see little Ragini being like, yeah, you know, mom, this needs work. Let's, you know. No, you are good. Not that posh. This is why I'm scared. Like, at some point, listeners, understand that Ragini and I are going to hang out and we're going to cook together. And, like, I'm going to be really intimidated, you know, because she's going to be judging every. She's going to be like, you know what? That was decent, but, you know, you need more of this. And your hing balance is off here. You know, it's going to be crazy.
Okay. Says the professional chef.
God. We need to do a live podcast for that one.
Yes, that would be so good. We should totally do that.
So we talked about my kind of journey into cumin. Obviously, you touched a little bit on yours. But the big question for me is, what's next? Because we got a whole new spice next month. I'm nervous. What am I cooking? And how bad am I going to have to study for this one?
So next month's spice is another sort of ubiquitous South Asian spice. Goes into, I mean, I don't want to put a percentage on it, but, you know, well over 70% of dishes on the subcontinent, I feel like I can say with some confidence. It's also become exceedingly popular as a coffee replacement-ish, not quite a coffee replacement, but sold at coffee shop drink in recent years. Any guesses?
Coffee shop? All right, I'm going to ask for a hint. Is there a particular industry in the West that loves to usurp this for health benefits?
Is there ever?
I know we're talking haldi or turmeric.
Yes, we are indeed. So we are going to go down the yellow brick road next month.
There's the dad jokes coming in.
Do what I can.
Yeah. Cool. So we're talking turmeric. What am I cooking?
And you will be cooking a Bangan Partha.
Oh, all right. I got this one.
Which I imagine you've done a few times.
Yeah. Once or twice. But we're going to put a traditional spin on this, and then we're going to put a kind of elevated modern approach to the plating alone on this.
Ooh.
So we're doing two.
Ooh, I can't wait to see what this is. I'm so excited. Partha is one of my favorite things.
It's going to be so good.
Yeah.
No pressure, oh, right? Man.
No, none at all. Well, I will say it's one of those recipes that is very much the simpler the better. Like, I think it's really easy to over-engineer a Bangan Partha, but it is actually just like, it's the restraint for this one. You reckon?
Yeah, that was your recommendation. Like, don't over-chef this, chef.
No, you do what you want. I'm just saying.
Well, as always, thank you everyone for listening. I hope you enjoyed our level of dorkiness and our history lessons. Mostly Ragini. I'm just here for the deep, sultry tones of my voice.
Lots of comments on your voice. Lots and lots of comments. So, you know.
Well, as always, please subscribe, rate, do all the fun stuff that you cool kids do nowadays. Thank you for listening. I had a blast today. Ragini, as always, you're just such a rock star. You do an incredible job. So thank you for making me look way cooler than I am.
Right back at you, Chef. This is really fun. And thanks for listening, everyone. And just a little FYI, there's some sort of glitch on our Apple podcast where it only accepts 5-star ratings. So if you can't leave less than a 5-star, don't worry about it. That's what's supposed to happen.
Wow. 2 jokes in 1 podcast. Stay tuned next time for 3 jokes. Thank you guys for listening, and we will talk with you soon.
See you later.